Kim Moody is CEO and Director of Canadian Tax Advisory at Moody's Gardner Tax Law, and he joins me now. Kim, such a pleasure talking to you again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, so let's first of all talk about the decision or the announcements that Andrew Scheer came down with this week, because he talked about rolling back many of the small business tax changes that have hurt small business and hurt the creation of small business. I remember you and I talked all through that whole period that Bill Morneau was trying to see that through. Sounded like he dropped some of the worst proposals, but it sounds like there were still some that got adopted that have hurt small business. I haven't seen too much detail about what that refers to. Can you shed some light on that? What are some of the problems that you've had, and what would you like to see the government do if it does change after the election?
Sure. So you're right. The current government did adopt the two biggest things that they adopted was what's called tax on split income, which is the so-called income splitting rules, or as the government likes to call it, income sprinkling, which I don't like that phrase. But in any event, they adopted those rules, which apply to virtually every single private business owner in Canada, whether you're small or large. The government likes to promote nauseatingly that these rules don't apply to every single private business owner, but they do. And that's just simple fact. And so these rules that they adopted basically try to prevent any sort of income splitting with any non-arm's length, meaning related, party. And they are so complex that it, no pun intended, but taxes the brain of even a tax specialist like myself.
Well, let me ask you, because the immediate thing that I think of is sort of a tradesman whose wife does the books, because I know many people who are in that circumstance. So how has their life changed before and after?
Well, it in terms of the tradesperson example and being able to pay salaries to that tradesperson's spouse, really there's no change. These new rules apply to the extent that you're incorporated. So if you have a company and the spouse is a shareholder of that company and you want to pay dividends to that spouse, now the default rule is that any income paid to that spouse needs to be reasonable in the circumstances, if you want to call it that. And it's a lot more complicated than that, but just in order to put it in plain English. And if it's not reasonable, then the tax on that dividend will be taxed at the highest tax rate applicable to that dividend. So no graduated tax rates, and automatically you're taxed on the first dollar with no personal tax credit. So that's the damage, is that all of a sudden you could have a low-income or middle-income family, let's say they earn $50,000 collectively as tradespeople. If you pay a dividend to that spouse, now all of a sudden they're at the highest tax bracket.
And the highest tax bracket is what in Alberta?
Well, on that dividend, it'd be 43%. But you got to remember, there's already been corporate tax paid of about 12%. And so the collective tax rate is pushing 50% on that dividend.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is ridiculous, right? So so what did Mr. Scheer announce this week? He announced that these rules, he's not going to eliminate the rules, which I was really hopeful that he would, but he announced that instead of eliminating them totally, he's going to exempt spouses and common law partners from the rules, which is a really, really good start. But as I've told the Conservative Party and on publicly on my LinkedIn account, they need to go further. But this is a hell of a first step.
Because the other example might be kids also being shareholders. And you can imagine that situation in a number of farm operations.
Absolutely. There's no question that kids, either directly or indirectly, in some cases it is reasonable to pay dividends to kids, but of course in some cases, you know, some people may view it not to be. And those rules have not been proposed to be changed by the Conservative Party.
You know, I think you should make the argument that you made before in this, now that you're reminding me of all of it, is that it shouldn't really matter whether a person owns shares in a private company or they own shares in WestJet. It should be treated the same way. And so that's really kind of stuck with me, is that it shouldn't be a requirement that you have to do a certain amount of sweat equity in order to justify a dividend coming from that share, because I'm not required to go and work and clean the airline or clean up the cabin after I've flown on WestJet because I'm a WestJet shareholder. So why would we have a higher standard on a small business shareholder?
Absolutely. And that's certainly an argument that's been put forward to deaf ears, but I totally agree with that.
Okay. Is it because of the size of the dividend that the dividend relative to the amount that you'd be owing would be is so small? If they had a yield that's in the 3-4% range, do you think that they might be able to make a comparable argument? Is it the problem that the amount that they're getting paid in a dividend is so much higher?
Well, that's been the identified issue is that the amounts being paid to inactive shareholder family members is well in excess of what reasonable returns might be. And thus, that's what's generated these new rules and the cause for concern by the Department of Finance and the Liberal Party. I totally disagree with that.
Okay, perfect. I just wanted to get that on the table. So they'll at least accept spouses and common law partners. The other, you said that there were two really big changes. What was the other one?
The second one was the change on the taxation of passive investment income inside a company. And I'm not sure if you recall us talking about this a couple of years back, but the first iteration of the rules, you know, were proposed rules were very, very punitive. There could have been a flow-through taxation rate in Alberta of 73%.
Wow. And you have to remind people why that is. The only other time that I've talked about passive income has been how damaging it is for anybody who wants to have a small company that operates rental housing, because rental housing units are considered passive income, and it's taxed at, I think, 48%. It's an absurd tax level.
Yeah, and so the theory of these proposed changes was that, hey, listen, if you have a worker, you know, an employee who wants to accumulate income or passive income, you know, like let's say they want to, you know, invest in a GIC, well, they're going to pay after-tax personal rates, and therefore the amount that that they accumulate is lower than what would be inside a private company because the tax rate's inside a private company. So that was the ultimate perceived mischief, which again is ridiculous, but for a whole variety of reasons that we probably don't have time to talk about, but that was the perceived mischief. And so after a whole bunch of backlash, they backed down. Now, what they did is they said, listen, if you have more than $50,000 of investment income inside your private company and you have a business either in that company or through an associated company, then any dollar in excess of $50,000, you're going to lose $5 of the ability to utilize the small business deduction. And the small business deduction is you get the low tax rate of roughly 12%, is now 11% in Alberta, on the first $500,000 of business profits. And so you'll lose, if you do the math, if you have $150,000 of investment income inside your company or associated company, then you'll lose that rate.
Wow,
so then it jumps up to 26% in Alberta.
That
now
seems really low. I mean, if for somebody who might be saving up for an investment, saving up for a capital purchase, saving up to buy machinery and equipment, that doesn't seem like a very high amount to be having in your bank account if you've got that as a goal.
Well, and that's a good chunk of the argument. So what Mr. Scheer proposed earlier this week was to eliminate that rule altogether, which is really good policy in my view. And it's interesting to note that some other provinces across the country, New Brunswick and Ontario, did not follow the lead of the federal government in adopting that rule, which is very unusual, which tells me that the provincial tax policymakers of those provinces looked at this and thought, yep, this is really silly. And I'm anxious to see if Alberta in its upcoming budget will do the same. I'm hopeful.
Interesting.
Yep.
Let me ask one more about something Tarek raised yesterday. So Tarek said that he had a small business, and so he's been looking at that $500,000. I thought it was the lifetime capital gains exemption, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's that $500,000 limit for your business to be considered a small business and have the lower tax rate. He wanted to go into business with another friend who had a small business, and they wanted to create a third entity. But what he said is that because they'd all be considered now related companies, that they would, instead of each being able to have that $500,000, it would just be $500,000 for all three. And he said, well, you know what? It's making me think I don't even want to do this business deal. So that was what he relayed to me. And as I'm talking it through, I think it must be this $500,000 bar.
Like it, yeah.
Yeah. So what is that something new or has that always been
no,
the case?
No, that's been around for roughly, certainly as long as I've been practicing, which is a lot of years. So that rule likely has been around for about, I can double check, but at least 40 years. And basically it's a rule that prevents, for example, me setting up a company and then say my wife setting up a company and then my four kids setting up an additional four. So now I have six companies that basically all do the same thing. And then, so in that situation, you could be deemed to be associated, although technically you may not be, but you could be deemed to be associated so that collectively those six companies only get one access to the low $500,000 in business rate.
And, just
and
so
I
what,
think that rule is fine.
You think it's okay?
Oh, it's fine. Yeah, it prevents you know, obvious mischief, in my view.
Okay, so just so people understand why it is that 500,000 bar is so important, is that once you've got over 500,000 in profit, now the general corporate rate applies. And just explain what the difference is in the general corporate rate versus the small business rate, because there's quite a huge discount.
It is, yeah, and it's it's continuing to go down a little bit, but the current rate is 11%, I believe, off the top of my head, in Alberta on the first $500,000 of small business profits. And so you'll pay a corporate tax rate on that. If you're not eligible for that rate, or if the company is not, then that rate goes to the general corporate rate, which is 26% right now, going down to eventually 23%. And so, but what people need to understand is that that's not a permanent tax rate, because when you take that money out, which eventually everybody must take that money out, then you'll pay tax on dividends. And right. So at the very minimum, that's a deferral. And so for business owners that are expanding, small business owners, it's a very useful thing to have that low rate, because they can use, cheaper after-tax dollars to buy equipment, to hire people, to effectively expand their business. And so to jump up to 26%, that hurts.
No kidding. Okay, let me pause you, because something else that might hurt, and I don't know, is this financial transaction tax. I don't even know if I know exactly what it is, but Elizabeth May seems to think it's going to raise billions of dollars. We'll see if you can help us understand it when we get back. Kim Booney is my guest. He is CEO and Director of Canadian Tax Advisory at Moody's Gartner Tax Law. Stay with us on 770 CHQR. Well, as Pat asked in the break, well, if you have to pay that high a tax, why would anybody set up a rental housing unit? Exactly. Why were there so many condo conversions? So, because no one could make any money at rental housing. Sometimes politicians can be such dunderheads. Like, it'd be so easy to stimulate a construction boom in rental housing. All you have to do is provide a proper tax rate to it, but they don't want to do that. Anyway, that's my editorial comment. We've got Kim Moody, CEO and Director of Canadian Tax Advisory at Moody's Gartner Tax Law. I want to find out what a financial transaction tax is. Sounds like it could raise $15 billion a year by imposing a 0.5% tax on all financial transactions. And they give an example here, such as the sale of stocks and bonds. So, Kim, give us an idea. How would this be applied? What are they talking about?
Well, first off, I'm not an expert on this particular policy, but I will say that to suggest that you can just simply blindly and routinely apply a tax and think that that's not going to impact, society in general in a negative way, that's just foolhardy. And to take $15 billion, apparently, is the estimate out of the system, again, that's foolhardy. So, because ultimately, who is that going to impact? It would impact everybody who has pension assets, non-registered assets. So something like that, this has been talked about forever. I really don't see it coming unless somehow, very left-wing governments get elected.
Well, it's funny because the PBO says the revenue figure could be off by a factor of 2 or 3 in either direction, attributing the high-level uncertainty to the fact that a financial tax of this scale has not been tried in an open economy before.
Right.
I think it's very interesting that you should say it, because I don't know how many times pension funds decide to move their assets around, but they've got gazillions of dollars. So if they're paying a 0.5%, that would have a huge impact on the trading practice.
Yeah, no question. But ultimately, who hurts from that? The pension holders, right? The beneficiaries of the pensions. So easier said, much, much easier said than done. But much, much more complicated from an economic perspective.
So they said that around the world, I think 44 of these types of taxes have been implemented before, generating a total of $38 billion, to give you an idea of just how huge this one would be. Have you ever seen a financial transaction tax implemented any other way? I'm just trying to think through all the ways in which it could be potentially used. Like, what I was worried about is every time you try to pay for a restaurant meal using your debit card, it's a financial transaction that they can track. Why wouldn't they just stick another 0.5% on that too?
Yeah, again, Danielle, I'm not a financial tax expert. Certainly studied it, but from what I've seen from the writings, yes, something like that would be proposed to be taxed. But when you think about all the transactions that happen on a daily basis, yearly basis, I mean, the proposition could be huge. But again, if money comes out of the system, somebody's paying. And who's paying? It's everybody.
You have to always wonder about what would people do if they had large amounts of money that would be taxed this way. Because there are legal mechanisms to, I would imagine, move to another trading jurisdiction in order to avoid the tax, wouldn't there be? Or is there a way to even close those loopholes?
I could certainly envision something like that happening. But I guess the devil would be in the details of how they apply the tax.
Okay. Do you have any comment on, someone's asking the question about whether it's true that the Liberals will be taxing the sale of principal residences. I think you and I talked about that before, and they were tracking it, and I think the whole purpose was to just see the level of speculation. Somebody did, at a town hall meeting by Adam Vaughan, propose a sliding scale for capital gains taxes, but I don't think it's an active policy, but am I being naive here?
My suspicion is it's not an active policy as well, but I also think it would be naive to think that the Department of Finance, and I've said this publicly many times, but I think it would be naive to think that the Department of Finance and, you know, existing governments would not reconsider how principal residences are taxed, because there's some significant gains that presently are sheltered. I don't believe that the policymakers back in the early 1970s, when this became law, thought that they would be sheltering, you know, $2, $3, $4, $5 million in gains from tax. So I think there probably is an interest from policymakers to relook it. But, you know, this particular one that I saw from the Liberals, it's a little scary to see what they're proposing. But do I think it's an active policy? Probably not.
All right. Thank you so much for giving us your assessment. I sure appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You got it. That's Kim Moody, CEO and Director of Canadian Tax Advisory at Moody's Gardner Tax Law.